You're listening to The Radiator, 105.9 FM, WOMMLP, Burlington, Vermont. I'm Shayla Shapiro, and this is Write the Book, the show for writers and curious readers. Write the Book features interviews with authors, poets, illustrators, agents, and editors. And this is the fastest I have ever gotten here. I'm amazed. It took me like 10 minutes. I flew. Anyway, today on Write the Book, you're going to hear a new interview with local organic gardener and writer, Ron Krupp. Ron Krupp has been involved with local farm and food issues in Vermont for 39 years. He started one of the first farmers markets in the early 70s in Brattleboro. And 29 years ago, Ron published the Green Mountain Farmer, a monthly Vermont newspaper dedicated to farm and food issues. He was a commercial organic biodynamic vegetable grower for 10 years. He coordinated the 3-acre, 165-plot Tommy Thompson Community Garden in the Intervale for 15 years. And he teaches gardening to interns at Heartbeat, a farm community in Hardwick for adults with disabilities. You'll hear more about that in a minute. His farm and garden commentaries have been a feature on Vermont Public Radio for over 12 years. And his first book, The Woodchuck's Guide to Gardening, published in 2005, presents anecdotes in history, poetry and wit, politics, stories, and down-to-earth organic gardening tips. His second book, Lifting the Yoke, Local Solutions to America's Farm and Food Crisis, was published in 2009. When I spoke with Ron Krupp last week, I began by asking him to talk about his background, how he came to Vermont, and how he became a gardener here.
Well, when I got out of the service in spring of 1969, I came back to Vermont. I had gone to the Antioch Putney Graduate School of Education in 66 and got a master's degree in teaching. Mm-hmm. And, you know, I did some teaching and I worked also in Canada for a government agency similar to VISTA, and then I came back to Vermont, and I was called up in the service, but when I got out, came back to Putney, which is where the Antioch Putney Graduate School was, and I started working at Hillendale Farm, which was an organic biodynamic farm where we raised apples, beef, and vegetables.
Oh, okay.
And that's when I sort of began my official gardening, farming career. My first garden took place down in eastern Kentucky. I worked in a coal mining area, and my neighbors came by with a mule and an apron full of seeds on a hillside, Valley and Crick Gamble. So that was really my first garden. That was 65.
Okay, and then when you worked for the organic farm in Vermont, what year was that?
Well, I started when I came back after getting out of the service. I started working at Hillendale Farm in the spring of 69.
Okay, so were there a lot of organic farms already in Vermont at that point?
No, there are almost none. We were really one of the first organic farms, and a lot of people made fun of organics in those days. I remember quite well. Mm-hmm. But, you know, it was sort of it was a well-run farm, and I worked under a fellow by the name of Erling Anderson, who was a biodynamic farmer who grew up in Sweden and was trained in Germany. And we sold a lot of vegetables and made a lot of cider.
Yeah.
Real cider, not the kind that we drink today.
Right.
I think we had 8 different kinds of apples, and it wasn't pasteurized, and the last pressings were done in November, and so the cider was quite unique because it had that sort of sweet and sour taste, and it was great, and it lasted a long time.
You mentioned in one of the books, you mentioned your having enjoyed a drink that was made with apple cider vinegar and honey. What's that called?
Oh, yeah, when we hayed, it was a traditional Vermont drink that farmers would use when they were haying because it was called Haymaker's Switchel.
Oh, okay.
And I assume it was like an electrolyte today, and you just used apple cider vinegar and honey.
Okay.
And you could use maple syrup. But it had, again, that tart, sweet taste, and it was great when you were haying in the summertime.
Yeah, yeah.
And now they're making it. I noticed that someone's making haymaker switchel.
Oh, they are?
Selling it.
Oh, okay. Have you had it yet?
No, I can make my own pretty easily.
No, I'm just wondering if the one that's being marketed is any good or if it...
Oh, I don't know. I'm not sure, but I know, you know, I still make it for myself in the heat of the summer days.
Yeah, yeah. Well, your first book was The Woodchuck's Guide to Gardening.
Mm-hmm.
And I know that it's a favorite resource for a lot of gardeners that I know. And I was wondering, how do you think our unusual winter is going to turn to spring this year? Do you have any predictions for the spring of 2012?
I have no more predictions. I think for the last 7 or 8 years I've noticed changes. And I've been gardening since 69, and there's nothing that you can figure out anymore. I mean, I think we should assume that we're going to have more extremes mm-hmm. of rain and heat. And my garden's down in the Intervale at the Tommy Thompson Community Garden, along with all the other gardeners, and we have 3 acres, 165 plots. We had 5 to 6 feet of water that went through. Besides, we had spring flooding, and that really set us back. So I'm just assuming that we're going to have heavier amounts of rain and more heat, and so people will have to, figure out how to adapt to those situations, those conditions. And I'm not sure how you do that, except that you have a different expectation. I mean, I try to get in the Intervale. It's considered one of the banana belts in Vermont, so I get my peas in April, and I can extend the growing season up till December, but I couldn't do that this year. I didn't. Last year I got my peas in, but then with the flooding in the spring, I had to plant them 3 times, and then the fall crops, in which the flood came, Irene came in the end of August, I lost pretty much everything that was below the water line of 5 feet. I still had beans, and I had some tomatoes and pole beans. But I couldn't use any of the greens, and I did use some of the potatoes, carrots, and beets, and that was up to me. I couldn't sell anything because of the contamination.
Right. So you just made choices for yourself about whether or not you're
going to... I just made personal choices,
yeah. Now, one of the things that you talk about in the Woodchuck's Guide to Gardening, which I enjoyed reading about, was the building the cold frame, which helps you to plant in Vermont in, you know, early in the season, like in late March. So have you done that already this year? Are you?
Well, I was just thinking about it the other day. I could probably, what I do in the spring, I have a cold frame in front of my house, and I usually clean it off, dig it up, add some compost, and then I start planting radishes, spinach, onions, lettuce, greens and crops, and then I cover it. I have covers for the cold frame. They're called lights. If you look down the Connecticut River Valley, down in especially Massachusetts, they had a large tobacco growing area, not the regular tobacco, but leaf tobacco.
Mm-hmm.
And they had acre upon acre of green of these cold frames and tobacco barns. You can still see them in Western Mass down around Greenfield and Deerfield.
Oh, okay.
So I start stuff early, and some of that, those plants, I'm usually getting salads from early to mid-May, plus I include nettles and violets and, dandelions.
Mm-hmm.
So it's a nice mix early on. And then some of those plants, I plant brassicas, broccoli, cauliflower, those type of plants, and cabbages, and take the young plants down to my community garden plot.
Now, your cold frame is at your house?
Yeah, it's right in front of my house. I also have cold frames. Now, I have raised beds down at the community gardens, but I have an actual cold frame with just planks of wood and some tops, some glass. tops.
Right. The lights are glass and they...
Well, they're actually a type of plastic because the glass always seems to break. And one thing, if you use old storm windows, you got to check them for lead. So lately I've been using fiberglass tops.
Okay.
And they're easier to move.
Yeah. And then also I noticed that you said that you build the cold frames, which are sort of like raised beds as well, mm-hmm. with these lights on top. They have a little bit of an angle to them. So why is that? Why do you do that?
Well, you get a better angle to the sun. I have a southeast exposure in front of my house, so the greater the angle, the greater the heat.
Okay, sure.
And, you know, it's the same with greenhouses. With, you know, depending on the angle. Most greenhouses don't do that anymore, but if you look at some of the older appropriate technology, they'll talk that if you can get a 45 or greater angle, that you'll use more heat. I also have a bay window in my house, and that's where I have a lot of, I start a lot of seeds, and I use milk jugs, and I fill them with water, and then they heat up during the day so that they'll provide warmth to the young plants that come up, you know, in the bay window that mm-hmm. I start from seeds.
Mm-hmm. Okay.
So I just use a bunch of old woodchuck methods.
Yeah. I'm curious if there will be a sequel to the Woodchuck's Guide. Do you ever think about writing another gardening book?
It's already in the process. It's called, it won't surprise you, The Woodchuck Returns to Gardening Part 2. And I've probably written more than half of it, and I self-published my book, so hopefully it'll be out in the fall. It's a lot of work to publish a book. I like the creative process.
Yeah.
And then you got to go through all the permissions, and you got to get, like, for photographs and the ISBN numbers. I mean, it's quite a task. And
right.
So I try to spend at least an hour or two every day working on the book.
Okay.
The new book. And
great.
There's so much that, you know, I'll cover areas, obviously, that I didn't cover in the Woodchuck's Guide.
Yeah. I have some questions later about your publishing experiences mm-hmm. and marketing the books. But first, let's talk a little bit about your second book, Lifting the Yoke, Local Solutions to America's Farm and Food Crisis. I was wondering if we could start by your just reading something from Lifting the Yoke.
Sure. I have a section in the preface called Wherever There is Darkness, There is Light. I'll just start reading. My passions run deep when I read and observe how farming is losing its soul to agribusiness. And it's all happening so fast. What we need are alternatives to the corporate global food system, especially in light of the current worldwide recession. Local food and farming initiatives would give people employment, put money back in our rural communities, and provide a sustainable way of living for years to come. One thing's for sure, it will take a concerted effort to create local renewable food models. What's needed is a concentration of farmers, regional producers, food processing centers, local markets, distribution networks, and infrastructures like slaughterhouses, mills, and creameries. Veterinarians, truckers, feed store managers, and farm machinery dealers are also a critical part of the mix, as are land use policies that provide opportunities for farmers to stay on the land, plus training for new farmers. Farmers need to organize and empower themselves through political action, such as collective bargaining. Wheat farmers in North Dakota took a courageous step by stopping the importation of genetically modified spring wheat seeds for the entire states. For too long, farmers, especially dairy farmers, have been placed at the bottom of the manure heap, sometimes by their own doing, allowing middlemen to take most of the cash from the milk can. Consumer groups need to stand fast with farmers for more fairness in the marketplace. They also need to be educated about farm and food issues and to begin to take control of their food dollars. As an example, the buy local movement is the rage these days. Customers of restaurants are demanding that local food be served. So I could go on, you know, yada, 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 but since I wrote the book, there has been a tremendous initiative in local farm and food initiatives in Vermont. And I talk about the 20-25% change. We're basically 95% dependent on outside food sources. It's probably lower than that, but nobody has come up with a recent figure.
Mm-hmm.
I think my goal was to so we would be 75% dependent. And not too long ago, the Farm to Plate Initiative, which came from the legislature and Vermont Sustainable Jobs Fund, also came up with that 25% change.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
So what I tried to do in my book was to talk about corporate industrial agriculture and then go into hunger and obesity, and then on a more positive note, looked at local farm-to-school solutions, and then I looked at market solutions, and I'm glad to touch on some of those areas if you wish.
Yeah. I wonder if you can talk a little bit about Wall Street's role in the farm and food crisis.
Well, let me just talk a little bit about agribusiness.
Okay.
Which is, there are very few corporations that control the farm and food culture in our country. Monsanto, Cargill, Archer Daniels, Midland, Nestle, Philip Morris, McDonald's, and Walmart, in cahoots with the federal government, really control our food system. I call them, I have a name for them, CAIM, the Corporate Agricultural Industrial Machine. They're also referred to as industrial agriculture, factory farming, or agribusiness.
Mm-hmm.
And CAIM can be described as an oligopoly in which a small number of corporations control the vast global food market. They have, accompanying them are the lobbyists, which influence legislation in the halls of Congress. A similar scenario exists with energy, insurance, investment companies, and the pharmaceutical industry. CAIM could not exist without the support of a global financial network, the same institutions that helped to create our current economic meltdown. So they're all connected.
Mm-hmm.
They're all connected with Wall Street and where their money comes from. And just to give you an example, most people in Vermont, across the country, shop at supermarkets, and 20% of the trucks on the road carry food, and it would only take less than a week for there to be shortages in the supermarket. Now, I'm not trying to be a doomsayer. I'm just trying to show you how dependent we are
mm-hmm.
on the interstate highways, on trucking, on food traveling vast distances. Half the garlic in the world today comes from China. On average, it's around 2,000 miles that it takes food to get here. I think it costs 25 cents to ship a head of lettuce.
Gosh.
So this is a vast, system
right.
that's controlled by a handful of corporations, and corporations in Vermont or small businesses that were once here, like Annie's Naturals up in Calais. They're now in California. Earlier Earth's Best Baby Foods, which started in the Champlain Valley, they're in California. Green Mountain Gringo Salsa now is made in North Carolina.
You're saying because they've all been sold to larger corporations?
Yeah. Stonyfield Yogurt, Ben and Jerry's, and the ice cream's not the same anymore. I mean, it's been, the quality is, and while I think they've done good work on a social scale, I mean, this food is filled with a lot of sugar and fat.
Yeah.
And it's nice to have it now and then, but, I don't want to get into that. I don't want to get into Ben and Jerry. They've done good work, and they do support local farmers, but they were bought out years ago.
Yeah.
And that tends to happen. Not everyone's done that. But if you look at the organic food industry, they've basically been sold out years ago. All the processed food. Now, I'm not talking about local farmers markets or CSAs or local restaurants
right.
and value-added foods in Vermont. But if you were to look at a graph our chart of the main organic food industry. They're owned by General Mills, Heinz, you name it.
Mm-hmm.
Dean Foods controls, I think, around 45% to 50% of milk processing in Vermont. They own Horizon Foods, which is the organic milk producer. They have farms out west that have 5,000 to 10,000 cows. They have no trespassing signs. That milk is sent west and east, and it's been ultra-pasteurized, tastes cooked.
Yeah.
And those, you know, Horizon is, they're big, and they're owned by Dean Foods. And the other large organic milk producer is Organic Valley, and they do great work. It's more of a cooperative. But they also ultra-pasteurize their milk because they have to send it long distances.
Well, I was going to ask you, I found one thing that you wrote about really interesting, and that is the importance of immigrant labor to small farms in Vermont, but I'm sure in other areas as well. So I wonder if you could talk a little bit about that.
Yeah, I think about 60% or 1,500 migrant farm workers from Chiapas in Mexico. It's mostly Chiapas because people know each other, and then they come here for 2 to 3 years. Some are legal, some are not, and we need to change the laws to make it legal.
Mm-hmm.
They come here, and then they don't want to be here, but it's decent money, and they send it home, and then they can invest in their local communities.
Right. It sounds from what you wrote like they can make per hour what they would make per day back home.
That's true, and the irony in all this is that our agricultural policies, subsidies that we provide, for example, to farmers that grow corn, they get subsidized, and then so the corn, the price of corn goes down. It can be exported to countries like Mexico. If you're growing corn in Mexico and you get cheap imported corn, then maybe you can make a living growing corn. And so you come to this country. I mean, I'm stretching this a little bit,
mm-hmm.
but I don't think it's far from the truth. So our policies, in effect, subsidize farmers here. We send cheap corn to other countries. They can't afford to grow it, so the farmers there come here and work. I think it used to be, you know, there were no Mexican migrant farm workers on dairy farms. We've always had migrant farm workers in the apple orchards. In fact, when I was a young hippie years ago on Green Mountain Orchard, we had a Jamaican crew, we had a black crew from Mississippi, and we had a young hippie crew.
Mm-hmm.
And at that time, Green Mountain Orchards was producing 100,000 bushels. Now I think they just have Jamaicans, and they do a lot of pick-your-own. A lot of the apple orchards couldn't afford to pay people because part of the reason was a lot of their apples were putting those stickers on the apples.
Mm-hmm.
So they would be sending them to Massachusetts where they would be stickered and then they would sell them. And it just wasn't worthwhile. So a lot of the orchards have cut back, but they do a lot of pick-your-own and they make those delicious donuts, which I'm not supposed to eat, but they're awfully good.
Yeah, they are.
Mrs. Hackett makes some great ones up at Hackett's Orchard in South Ebro, as does Nick Coles over in Shelburne. The reason I called my book The Woodchuck's Guide to Gardening is that I wanted to thank all the local people who taught me over the years about farming and gardening.
Mm-hmm.
I worked on farms, I worked in nurseries, and if it wasn't for these people, I wouldn't have written the book, so I wanted to raise the persona of the woodchuck and thank them. That's why I call it The Woodchuck's Guide to Gardening.
Guide to Gardening, okay. Well, part two of Lifting the Yoke mm-hmm. deals with obesity and also starvation and just some of these issues that have been the result of the change in farming. And I wanted to ask your opinion of Michelle Obama's campaign, Let's Move, which is this nationwide initiative to end childhood obesity and improve nutrition. I'm wondering if you know very much about that campaign and if you think it's having an effect.
Oh, I think it's great. I think, again, it's odd. There is a Vermont connection, because when she started growing with the school children, the organic garden in front of the White House, Tom Stearns of High Mowing Seeds sent her some organic seeds. And Monsanto, which pretty much controls the genetically modified seed market, I think 80% of corn, 90% of soybeans is now comes from genetically modified seeds. They complained to the White House about being sent organic seeds from High Mowing Seeds in Vermont. That's just a little aside. But I think she's great. You have to realize that 25% of four-year-olds in this country are obese. Now, to be fair, that figure, a lot of the kids on Indian reservations, children, have a high rate of obesity.
Mm-hmm.
And but, you know, obesity is a new phenomenon in this country.
Mm-hmm.
In 1967, when Robert Kennedy went down to Mississippi, to the Mississippi Delta, he was the Attorney General, he saw thin, malnourished people. Today, if he went down there and if he was alive, he would find malnourished people who were obese.
Mm-hmm.
So it hasn't been that long in this country that we've become a nation. I think two-thirds of people in this country are overweight, one-third are obese. Diabetes has doubled in the last 10 years.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, when you look at people's blood sugar, as one's weight goes up, one's sugar goes up.
Right.
And there's something called prediabetes. And my friend and partner, Peggy, she's a primary care physician.
Mm-hmm.
And she gave me a figure the other day, nearly 80 million or 35% of people in this country have prediabetes.
Wow.
Today it's about 11.3. If this continues, one in three people will have diabetes by 2050. There's very little public health money that goes toward, I mean, you remember with smoking, how we there was tremendous marketing and advertisement campaign to get people to stop smoking. We need to do the same thing with obesity.
Yeah, we need to educate people so they understand what's happening to them.
And if you educate children when they're young, they'll pass it on to their kids. And that's really the key, these farm-to-school programs where you teach children about how to grow food, good nutrition. And in Vermont, we're very fortunate, even though it depends on the particular school. You know, I live in South Burlington, and I remember, it was a couple of years ago, a group of us went to a school board meeting, and we took a platter of, my neighbor Nancy took a platter of corn dogs, fries, and forgot what else, and we gave them to the superintendent and said, "This is what these kids are eating." My point is that usually it's a local issue. Some schools have great healthy food programs, and other ones really suck. It's very political. Parents need to get involved.
Yeah.
That's my point. And kids, when they have the choice, they'll choose healthy food. I try to point out in the book that if we can teach children at a young age, then they'll pass it on to their kids.
Yeah.
So I think it's going to take at least a generation to change things.
Yeah. Well, then the third section of your book has to do with sustainable markets and regional solutions to these problems that we've been talking about. And I was wondering if we could discuss a little bit co-ops and CSAs and the popularity of these programs. It seems that these programs have exploded in recent years.
Yeah, I started back in the early 70s. I started the Brattleboro Farmers Market.
Mm-hmm.
And at that time, there were only probably four or five markets. and they've really taken off. And CSAs have even grown faster. First two CSAs in this country, that's where an individual or family will buy a share in a farm, and they'll receive a certain amount of produce each week. Pete's Greens up in Greensboro works with other farmers to supply bread, meat, chicken, and eggs, and he grows vegetables, so he'll deliver. He has a truck, and they are a big van, and they deliver food all over the northern part of the state. So they've really taken off.
Mm-hmm.
And they're more, I think CSAs in general are more affordable than farmers markets. Some people will shy away from farmers markets where they just don't feel comfortable. There was an interesting situation down in Brattleboro. Well, like I said, I started the Brattleboro Farmers Market in the early 70s, and mm-hmm. in those days, the low-income folks would come at the end of the day, and I'd give them a good deal.
Yeah.
They don't go to that market, and probably markets like the Burlington Market, because they don't feel comfortable. I mean, people go where they feel comfortable. So mm-hmm. down in Brattleboro, they did an interesting thing. Some local activist farmers and low-income folks got together, and they said, we need a solution to this. We want to provide healthy food. So they came up with the idea of a food basket. And so once a week, they would meet at a central location, and the farmer would bring a food basket for a family, or maybe two families would share. It was
$15. Mm-hmm.
And they also have farm coupons, and you can use EBT cards, the food stamp cards, at various farmers' markets. In Burlington, you have two markets, one down in the old North End, and then you have one, you know, at City Hall Park.
Right.
So, again, I mean, people shop where they feel comfortable. So it's good to have alternatives.
Yeah.
And I think where the CSAs are most successful is where they also provide an educational arm, where they either give people recipes, or they actually do, you know, they do food preparation right there.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. Are you involved in any of those at this point?
No, I grow pretty much all my own food. I also go up to a farm in Hardwick, you know, the center of the universe.
Yeah.
There's a farm up there called Heartbeat. There are 30 people that live there. It's for disabled adults.
Uh-huh.
And it's part of the Camp Hill movement. And I go up there every other week and teach gardening and farming to young interns.
Okay.
And they have about 2 acres of vegetables, and they have cows and pigs and, you know, chickens. And so they raise most of their own food. And so I go up there and teach. So I'm able to barter my work for some of the food.
Yeah, and
that's
Heartbeat, B-E-E-T, right?
Mm-hmm.
Which is fun. And is that a year-round endeavor, or are you just going there seasonally? Or
I just go seasonally, because
uh-huh.
it's a long way to go. And I have worked in other Camp Hill communities,
yep.
So I was well familiar with that. And so it's a great place to go. I mean, that's where I get my raw milk up there in the summer, and mm-hmm. can get, you know, some chicken and other things.
Now, I know that Hardwick is also where Claire's restaurant is, and,
mm-hmm.
and a lot of other things that are happening. You said it's the center of the universe. Can you talk a little bit about how Hardwick began to support regional sustainable food solutions in this way?
I know some of the people that are part of that network. Andrew Meyer, that started Vermont Soy, I think his family has been in dairy farming for years.
Mm-hmm.
He went to UVM. You know, he's a real mover and shaker. And then Tom Stearns is up there from, you know, High Mowing Seeds. It seemed like there was a core group of people, and there was a Center for Sustainable Ag, which brought all these leaders together.
Mm-hmm.
And they would meet, and for example, if an organic farmer needed help with seeds, purchasing seeds in the spring. There would be a sort of a loan program. And then they would share marketing ideas. It's a guy named Monty Fisher. I think he was, maybe he still is the director. So right in the center of Hardwick, you had this meeting space in an educational center where all these farmers would meet, and they would talk, and they would write grants because they had a non-profit entity. And then, of course, nearby you had Jasper Hill Cheese with that 10,000-square-foot cheese cave, which made artisan cheesemakers, gave them a place to age their cheese. You had, I'm trying to think of the name of the compost maker up there. But okay. The other unique thing is you had people investing. You sort of took the CSA model and raised it to the next level. So people, local people, like the woman at the bookstore, and I'll think of her name in a second, she invested in Claire's restaurant. And some of the local cheesemakers provided cheese. And in return, they got meals, and I'm not sure what kind of return they're getting. So that was sort of a model, and I think it came from the farmers working together. It's really exciting, and it's a model which is beginning to be, I mean, it's what they call a food hub or a regional food center, where you have the right ingredients, where one farmer is supporting another farmer. It draws tourists. Recently, the processing center moved to Hardwick, in which people can come in and produce value-added food.
Mm-hmm.
And that was a big thing. It was in the paper. It's been pretty successful, but I think they wanted to move, and they got grants, and then it moved to Hardwick because, again, people were drawn to that area.
Right.
Yeah. So the local pickle maker, you know, salsa maker, or whatever, could go in and have a place, whereas in their kitchen it wasn't large enough to produce that item.
Right. And well, it's like what you said earlier. People go where they're comfortable, and it sounds like this is a community that's making these small businesses feel comfortable to do this sort of work.
Yeah, I think it's working in Hardwick.
Yeah.
Oh, her name is Linda Ramsdale, and
okay,
she owns the Galaxy. And she invested, and other people invested in Claire's restaurant.
Yeah.
So, and it's happening not just with restaurants. Well, it happened with Sugar Snap in the Intervale. They now have Sugar Snap is also over in Ben and Jerry's building in South Burlington or Williston.
Uh-huh.
They had local investors. The Farmer's Diner. Over in Queechee has local investors.
Yeah.
Barnard Store, General Store, the store in Charlotte. So you find people investing locally, and that sort of goes beyond the CSA model.
Yeah. I did want to just ask you a little bit about your experience of publishing your books and marketing your books. You mentioned before how much work is involved. I'm just curious, between book one and two and now coming up on three, if you've changed the way that you approach the publishing process at all.
Well, one thing is I stay away from publishers.
Right. So you publish yourself. Yeah.
Well, I do it myself because you really have to be careful. Especially today with publishing contracts, distribution contracts, you really need to have someone look at it. I've been burned a number of times. In a way, it was okay. It's like my mother used to say, I hated her saying it, blessing in disguise. But I ended up self-publishing. In fact, I do talks on self-publishing. And I use one of the Woodchuck principles, it depends, which you can use for everything, of course, but it really depends on what your goals are. If you want to put together your poetry or the history of your town, you can get on-demand printing, and that's fine. Then you give them a disc, and within a week you have 30 books.
Mm-hmm.
But in my case, I needed to make part of my living from my books, and I consider myself sort of the Willie Loman of Vermont, because
yeah.
it's a very difficult, frustrating process. And now, you know, it's taken me 10, 12 years where when I call a bookstore and they know me.
Yeah.
You know, I want to know how the family's doing. So I've developed a personal relationship. To go back, I always ask people, you have to have a voice. You know, if you're interested, who's your audience? Where are you going to market? There are legal considerations to take in. Mm-hmm. But if you do put a book together, the hardest part is marketing and selling the books. It's not writing the book.
Yeah, yeah.
And I've had great people. My books all come from Vermont. I've worked with artists. I've worked with layout and design people, printers. I currently print up in Milton at Volante Printers. I've used Larry Brown and Barry. They're all good people to work with. And there are also a lot of shysters out there. You got to watch it. A lot of people say they'll help you get your book published and they'll do very little. And a lot of people are going to e-books and Kindles, and I just haven't made that transformation. I have trouble navigating that stuff.
Mm-hmm.
I consider myself an anachronism in a way, and I don't mind it, but how am I going to compete in the marketplace today?
Yeah.
I am working with a student at Champlain who's helping me make that transformation, but...
Yeah, is that Tim Brooks' program, the program mm-hmm. Tim Brooks runs for the Publishing Initiative?
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, that's a great program. Have you reprinted Lifting the Yoke? Have you done multiple print runs, or did you just do one large print run initially and that was enough?
Well, I couldn't afford to do a large one. I've sold about 17,000 copies of the Woodchuck's Guide to Gardening. I'm in my eighth printing.
Oh, wow.
And I'm going to my ninth within a month.
Oh, great.
With Lifting the Yoke, I've gone to my second printing.
Okay.
You have to have money to make money.
Sure.
And it's been harder and harder to sell books. A number of bookstores in Vermont have gone out of business, and you're competing with Amazon and ebooks and Kindle. And, you know, I always tell people you can bend a Kindle, but it doesn't seem to make any difference. I just find it's harder and harder. So I've been doing more talks around the state at libraries.
Uh-huh.
And I'm in my new book, I'm hoping to go through the Council on the Arts. I'm going to apply for the grant.
Right.
And see if I can get a grant to complete this, the second book. Because when you put a book together, as a publisher, it is a very creative process.
Mm-hmm.
And I love the process, but you need money to put it together.
Sure.
I don't make that much, even though I have sold a lot of books.
Yeah.
And people go, wow, but I said, well, you know, it's when you look at all your costs.
Yeah, yeah. It is, I was going to mention before I forget, I wanted to mention that I love the layout of the books. You know, they're really fun. You have a lot of great sort of boxes and side
mm-hmm.
notes, particularly in Lifting the Yoke.
I did. I wanted, that was more of an educational curriculum.
Mm-hmm.
That was different than the Woodchuck's Guide. That had a different rhythm.
Yeah.
In a book.
Yeah, definitely.
And I'm hoping to get back to that in The Woodchuck Returns. In fact, I have a character I'm including, sort of a muse called the Chuckster, who makes fun of me.
That's fun. Oh, that's great.
Because, you know, as organic folks, we can become a little too pure, but. He's a character, and you have to lighten your books up.
Mm-hmm.
And you have to make books so that people are inspired, not just provide information. There are a lot of good gardening books, but I'm not sure how much they inspire people.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
And so I include, you know, poems and songs and tell stories, and hopefully that'll, you know, carry people in. I think, you know, I've had to work hard, and because of my first book, which has been successful, that should help me with my second garden book, hopefully. I don't know.
Yeah. Well, I've just got one last question for you,
sure.
Ron. I'm just wondering if you have any suggestions or advice for people who want to participate in the local food revolution and how they can get involved.
Well, there's two ways to get involved. One, you can grow it yourself and then learn how to prepare food and preserve it. I think there's nothing, the biggest hobby in our country is gardening.
Mm-hmm.
And that's one way, but the other way is to support local farmers by going to your farmer's market, to your CSA, and also to educate yourself. For example, Monsanto now wants to introduce genetically modified salmon. Salmon, which have, you know. And they also want to introduce, it's very controversial, genetically modified alfalfa seed, which, because it's a perennial, could really affect organic, you know, farmers in the state. They also want to produce a genetically modified sweet corn. And I think people need to be aware of the issues. The big push has been that if you're going to have a product like many of the processed foods, you know, in the supermarkets, they have to be labeled. And, of course, they're afraid if they're labeled genetically modified, people won't buy them.
Mm-hmm.
It was like the BHT controversy, the, you know, milk hormone. So a lot of the milk companies in Vermont say BHT-free. And so I think people need to educate themselves about these issues. They need, if they feel strongly, they need to sign petitions. But just as important, they need to grow their own food and learn how to process food, as well as, you know, support local farmers. People have to remember that back in the 1840s, if I have another minute, I could just share this with
you. Sure.
In the town of Plainfield, 1840, there were 880 people. They produced 30,000 bushels of wheat, barley, oats, rye, buckwheat, Indian corn, and potatoes, and they harvested 3,000 tons of hay, 14,000 pounds of maple sugar, and 11,000 pounds of wool. They raised more than 10,000 sheep, cattle, horses, and pigs.
Mm-hmm.
They didn't count the chickens because everybody had them. In addition to farming and lumbering, there were three sawmills and two grist mills and other, you know, mills nearby.
Right.
So, there, you know, the whole local food and local energy movement were connected.
Yeah.
And I think that's, to me, everyone talks about we have to change toward a capitalism of sustainable activity. Two areas in Vermont that we could do that in are food and energy.
Mm-hmm.
And if they can be combined, it's even better. And people need to see that connection, including, of course, you know, lumber and wood and what we build with. And we could provide jobs and have a healthier economy and provide, you know, millions of dollars to and billions of dollars
right.
to the local economy. I think people need to see the connections, but in order to see the connections, they need to know how the world is working right now.
Yeah, yeah.
And so I think it's an educational thing, and that's but also get involved locally, and those
okay.
are two things that people can do.
All right.
And they can buy my books, too, if they
That's
want.
Right. They sure can. Now, where do they buy your books? Let's talk about that. Where do you sell your books?
Well, I sell them, like in Burlington now, the Crow Bookshop. I sell to a lot of garden centers,
yep.
bookstores. Most of the food co-ops carry my book, but garden centers, some of the Agways carry my books. Kenny drugstores.
Okay.
So, and you can get them directly from me too, but, you know.
What's your website?
If you just go to the Woodchuck's Guide to Gardening and, or Ron Krupp, K-R-U-P-P. Or, I can give you my email address at woodchuck37@hotmail.com.
So, Ron, I wanted to thank you very much for speaking with me today.
Thank you.
I hope you enjoyed that conversation with Ron Krupp, whose books, again, are The Woodchuck's Guide to Gardening and Lifting the Yoke, Local Solutions to America's Farm and Food Crisis. And then, as he said during the interview, he's got a new Woodchuck's Guide coming out soon, so keep an eye out for that. Today's Write the Book prompt is to write about your eating habits or the eating habits of someone you know. You can journal about how those habits have changed for the better or worse, how education has played a role, whether organic and or locally grown foods are an important part of this person's diet, and why or why not. Good luck with this prompt, and please listen next week for another. If you're interested in sharing this show with out-of-town friends, let them know they can stream it live at theradiator.org every Monday from 2 to 3. Archived episodes of Write the Book are also available on iTunes and at writethebook.podbean.com as free podcasts. If you have comments about the show, news about book-related events, or if you want to suggest a writing prompt, please send an email to writethebook@gmail.com. If I choose to use your prompt, I will credit you for it. Please remember that The Radiator is here thanks to community support and involvement. Everything that happens at The Radiator is contributed by someone. More information about The Radiator is available online at theradiator.org. This has been Write the Book. I'm Shayla Shapiro, and you're listening to The Radiator, 105.9 FM, WOMMLP, Burlington, Vermont.